Welcome to MoFo Perspectives, a podcast by Morrison Forster, where we share the perspectives of our clients, colleagues, subject matter experts, and lawyers.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. I think we will get started today, this morning, with the next. It's actually, believe it or not, Aaron, it is episode 14 in our series, where we are featuring ESG influencers who are leading transformative change. And I think we were just talking before, it's even more important to understand really what's at stake and how it can impact our country, our economy, and in fact, the world around us, and getting out of this sort of the whole and unhelpful political debates. But at any rate, I'm very pleased that you all have joined us this morning. We have Aaron Kramer, who I think most of you probably know, the president and CSO of BSR, who has for more than 30 years been leading the charge, working with business on issues related to ESG, and is really the gold standard in this area. And we have Daniela Balu Ares, who is the founder and CEO of the Leadership Now Project. And I'm really pleased that Aaron is going to lead us in a conversation where Daniela is going to provide some insights on how business leaders can really protect and support the democratic process in this period of time leading up to the 2024 election, and why that is so critical. It's critical for economic growth. It's critical for the rule of law, and it's really critical for social trust. And I think she's going to take us through an overview of the actions that businesses can take to generate awareness about business risks related to the election, and practically the steps that companies and business leaders can take to successfully navigate these uncertainties. And Aaron, I'm looking forward to your perspectives from BSR, given your huge membership that I know is very active. Just a minute or two of background on Daniela, who started the Leadership Now Project in 2017, really to focus business leaders on the critical actions required to renew American democracy. She began her career at Bain, and she worked in offices across the US, South Africa, and the United Kingdom. After that, she was a founding partner at Dahlberg, and then she spent 5 years in the Obama administration as senior advisor for the Deputy Development to the Secretary of State, serving under Secretaries Clinton and Kerry. She has been featured in the Harvard Business Review, the New York Times, Fast Company, Politico, and the World Economic Forum, among others. She's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and is really recognized as one of the leading voices in this area, particularly with the Leadership Now Project, which is a membership organization of business and thought leaders who are taking action, again, to really promote economic growth, the rule of law, and social trust, and the role that the businesses can play in that. So with that background, Aaron, can I turn it over to you?
Absolutely. Thanks, Suze, and thanks for your great leadership as well on the topics that we're here to talk about today, which are indeed absolutely central. And I may tuck in at some point how we're seeing some of our 300 plus member companies at BSR think about this question, which they most decidedly are. But first, I want to welcome Daniela. Daniela's got a stellar CV, as you see, and she's one of those rare people where you meet her and you say, yeah, the CV is great, but she's even greater in person. So I think you'll really enjoy hearing from her today. And Daniela, let me just start, just tell us a little bit about your background, because as we just heard from Suze, you've done a lot of different things in your career. Maybe what's the through line in your career, and how did it lead you to starting the Leadership Now Project?
Yeah. Thanks, Aaron. And thanks, Susan. And thanks to everyone for joining today. I think looking at what's ahead in 2024 is both interesting, important, and sometimes something we want to avoid. So I thank everyone for being here and being part of this discussion. And we'll make it, I think, hopefully it's like an interesting, sobering, but positive discussion in that regard. My background, look, I think in terms of through line, I have, during my time after graduating, I studied engineering undergraduate and operations research. And there would, my husband would joke and say that I was, we had these t-shirts that it said it was a complex world, but someone has to model it. And there was this like thinking of, I was always interested in how do we think about analysis systems and how the world's working. And I think that has been a through line from when I joined Dahlberg, because I had been working at the Nexus in 2000 when I was in graduate school of the HIV crisis that was happening in Africa. I'd worked in South Africa. We were just seeing the impacts. There was no access to drugs. And so there was this moment where I'd spent time on the business side in South Africa. I was now working with academics who were saying, look, this is a crisis that's emerging and we have no mechanisms, no dollars, no medicines to address it. And it was the confluence where you needed an understanding of business and systems and supply chains, as well as ultimately there was a huge push in policy to get major legislation and dollars flowing from the US government, and there was negotiations with pharmaceutical companies, et cetera. So I saw in that time how all of these pieces that often work in silos across business, government, policy, nonprofits had such a need for more interaction, integration. That was 2000. Many of the organizations and ideas that we're talking about here were just not in play at that time. So it was starting to piece those pieces together. And that's why ultimately I had a great experience at Bain for quite a few years. But when I saw Dahlberg forming and that kind of potential to work at shaping in 2002, shaping part of what was this going to look like to have more strategic ways of interacting across sectors to solve really important problems, I was really excited about that. And obviously over the last 20 odd years, many new institutions like BSR, like the whole field of ESG, et cetera, have emerged in that space.
And Dahlberg, just for people who may not be familiar with it, it's basically a social purpose consultancy. Is that a fair?
So when I joined in 2003, there were 7 of us in borrowed office space in New York. There's now about 25 offices around the world, more than 1,000 people working both consulting, but also data analytics, other pieces. But I think there was just such a, it was interesting there, and I'm sure in your work and those on the line, is that there was this like demand from talent who wanted to be part of solving these problems. And there were very few institutions. When I was graduating from grad school, you could go to the World Bank or you could go to a local nonprofit that was, but you know, there wasn't much in this in-between space. Mm-hmm. At a traditional consulting firm or otherwise, there was no like social impact process. There was maybe some pro bono project periodically. So, you know, I think a fair bit of this was driven both by the demand for talent and then obviously the need to address many challenges and crises that have emerged in the world.
And you're also in government and work quite a lot on the sustainable development goals. You want to say a little bit about that and how that feeds into what you're doing now?
Sure. Yeah. I think when I went into government, which was very new to me, having spent my time in kind of in business and as an entrepreneur, there were many things that were foreign about the large bureaucracy that is the U.S. government. But what was very adjacent to what I had worked on was the nature of the role that I had, which is really to look across the government. I was at the State Department, our kind of institutions in the foreign policy side and the private sector. And what were the ways we were going to bring those together? That was things like at the time there was OPIC, which is now a development finance institution. There was Millennium Challenge Corporation. USAID was modernizing. There was a variety of mechanisms to do that. But there was this window of opportunity with the negotiations around the next phase of the Millennium Development Goals, which became the Sustainable Development Goals, to create what we hoped would become a common framework. And then you could, everyone, business, government, et cetera, could see themselves around it. You could have data-driven outcomes that institutions were working towards together. So that, when I think it was a great ability for me to bring to the table also the networks that I had that were very much outside of government and link those into this kind of international process and bring in companies and be really deliberate about bringing companies and associations and others into the process. So that was a really, you know, a messy, but I think there were good outcomes that came out of that in terms of creating that framework.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And maybe a little messy, but actually you talked about being an engineer and wanting to look at systems. And I think the SDGs were miles ahead of where the Millennium Development Goals were in terms of looking at the overall ecosystem. Okay, so you leave government and not too long after you started the Leadership Now Project. What is it? What motivated you to do that?
Yeah, look, I've been seeing for some time from the time I joined government, which was in 2012, what felt like the disruption of our existing institutions. So a week before I joined government, we had the WikiLeaks scandal, right? And so the leaking of lots of diplomatic cables, et cetera, enabled by technology and other things. And as a kind of a newcomer to Washington, D.C., to the political world, et cetera, it's like I could feel the pace of change that was happening on the technology side, that was happening business outside, and how hard it was for the existing institutions to keep up with that, not be disrupted, et cetera. And so I was worried about that. As interesting as negotiating the SDGs and all of these things were, the flip side, I was worried about the institutions and their ability to withstand the pressures of those changes. And so, you know, I think after the 2016 election, which obviously was revealed a lot of polarization, and created a whole set of concerns in various constituencies, I felt that business people and business in general was really, I'd been part and involved in organizations working at the nexus of these spaces, but there wasn't really any institution or business organization that was saying, how do we reinvigorate this democracy? How do we protect it? What is business's role? What are the risks to business, et cetera? It was like didn't really sit in the mandate of many of the organizations, but the need and again, like with Dahlberg, there was demand for talent. There was talent who were wanting to step into a space. And in this case, I had such an explosion of concern and interest in my networks who had not been in government, but I had been, and who saw that there was something different to do. And we also have this problem that political engagement has been very, and policy, it's been very narrow. It's okay, you write a check or you make a policy statement, et cetera. And people felt disconnected. And the need for better institutions and better democracy is like such a more like sophisticated enterprise than these like very narrow elements. So started it and really tested out with academics. We started with Harvard academics and alumni, but we've broadened very much from there. But to say, what are the problems in the system? What are some intervention points that could both be meaningful and practical? And how do we drive change both with a strong intellectual foundation, but then the reality of how policy gets made, the fact that you need to be able to weigh in on policy that's made in Washington and ballot initiatives in states, et cetera. So we're able to both be hopefully in the kind of space of building understanding the business community, doing analysis, but also organizing our members and the people who decide to join our organization towards action in specific spheres.
Suze said in her setup, referenced the importance of social trust and trust in institutions. Certainly public institutions, but frankly, all institutions is not in a good place in our societies for a whole host of reasons. Maybe we'll touch on it. You mentioned your network. Give people a bit of a grounding in terms of what Leadership Now Project is. Who is in your network? What do they do? How do you activate them?
Yeah. So our membership are individual business leaders, typically at the executive level, often current, though some retired. We also have some who are young professionals, but the bulk of our members would be MBA alumni who are at senior executive roles in their organizations, are seeing the risk factors in their business, are also concerned at a personal level and want to be smarter about how do they engage. I would say that's I'd like to think if you're the thoughtful, committed, would like to be effective, would be the characteristics. And that has emerged and grown. It's been by referral. I would say we have a much larger kind of distribution list of our contacts emailed. When we think about members like you, it's a big commitment. It's time, it's financial resources. It's so we're not trying to have, you know, tens of thousands of members. We're trying to have hundreds or low thousands. We have 400 members. We expect to grow, but we don't expect to grow 10x. So it's really the first movers, those who are leaders in their state, in their industry, are going to work towards really achieving positive change and then influence broader ripples out of people. And we really seek to have that influence through having that broader distribution network and our communication platforms, and really also the business press around, let's make sure that people are really informed about what's at stake in democracy, why it matters for business and capitalism, et cetera.
And you, the your network cuts across the political spectrum, correct?
It does. So I'll give you an example of a couple of members, right? Anup Prakash is our lead in Wisconsin. He is, he was formerly ran Harley Davidson in India. He now runs a big manufacturing company in Wisconsin. He was formerly also in the Bush administration and a veteran. He's in his, I'm going to guess he's the same age as me, around 50. And he really had been in Wisconsin for some time and had was engaging with other business leaders there. And they were seeing real risks. They were seeing election administrators threatened. They were seeing real doubts around the legitimacy of elections. They were seeing their employees feel concerned and despair around the kind of local political environment. And he felt like it was really important to do something. And another, I also would have a member who's in an investment firm, right? And is looking at this, they're seeing kind of risk in their portfolio. They're thinking about, okay, we might be missing really big risk factors. How do I understand that better? So it's a diverse, we're 50-50 in terms of women and men. While we lean coastal, we do now have more and more members who are in states like Wisconsin and Ohio. And otherwise, another member is John Pepper, who was former CEO of Procter & Gamble, retired for many years, but really still engaged in the Ohio business community and concerned about their local Ohio context where they're trying to do redistricting. So increasingly in New York, we've been worried about vote by mail in New York and enabling. So it's increasingly we see it's not just like broad national concerns. It's what do I do in my business and what's happening in my state that is relevant.
Okay, terrific. And I'm sure you'll weave in some more about what Leadership Now Project does as we go through some questions. But now I want to turn to the elections. Let me just say up front, the statistics are there are dozens of elections taking place around the world. More than half the world's people live in jurisdictions where elections are being held this year. US, Russia, yes, they have elections. Likely the UK, European Parliament, India, Indonesia, Mexico, et cetera. We're going to focus here mostly on the US, though, and that's where Leadership Now Projects, the Leadership Now Projects activities are focused. So while I imagine that many people will have their own thoughts about this question, and before we go further, we'll take Q&A. You can go into the Q&A tab in the Zoom, offer up some questions. We'll get to it towards the back part of the discussion. Why should businesses and business leaders care about what's going on, what could happen in the U.S. elections in 2024?
Sure. Look, I think we think about this on two levels, but first, really around risk, right? So the political risk environment in the U.S. is higher than it has been in our lifetime. CEOs recognize that. Polling suggests from various sources, including, I'm sure, some of the polling you've done and others, right, is that there's a lot of concern about managing political risk, uncertainty, et cetera. So our first entry point on this is around risk and the obligation, of course, of companies to understand those risks. We think about three risks: election risks, right? So what can happen in the conduct of an election that would influence the country and business operations. Second, governing risks. And that includes things like both around the election, but also around the political environment. For instance, gridlock in Washington, so uncertainty around getting a budget passed, a government shutdown, et cetera, where we've seen threats or a political retribution of saying if companies engage on an issue that a political leader disagrees with, that's now a threat. ESG is an area where we've obviously seen that. There's both been rhetoric and there's actually been actual decision-making and pensions or other institutions that specifically seek to intervene in business decision-making, which is something that we worry about. And then there's societal risks, right? So overall polarization, how it's impacting your customers, your employees, and stakeholders, and their ability to work together, solve problems together. And the risk factors that even relate to things like political violence, et cetera. We've fairly systematically, we can share in the chat or otherwise, done that analysis of US political risks and gone a couple of levels deeper to say, let's give you examples of what that looks like, where we're seeing that happen, et cetera. We did experience some of those in 2020, right? So we had, for instance, there was quite a period where the results had not been certified of the 2020 election. So there, and that was an example where business really engaged. We helped organize some very significant public statements, behind the scenes coordination around companies, associations, to say, how do we remind Americans about the importance of the legitimacy of the election? That might take some time to get all the results, but that there is a process here that we believe in. And that if there's efforts to undermine that process, that's not in any of our interests. We've seen this before. I think the nature of the risks are somewhat similar and also arguably even greater this time because we've had some of the experience. I don't think they have to be fully greater. And I think that's when we talk about action, we now know what could come. And that, I think, gives us all agency at an institutional level and individual level to try to reduce those risks in this election.
Let's dig a little deeper on that. And obviously, we experienced January 6th, and now at least two of the lawsuits that the soon-to-be formerly anointed Republican nominee is facing are directly related to the 2020 election. So presumably, people don't need to understand what can happen. But I guess let me put a sharper point on that. Do you see business leaders thinking differently about 2024 based on what was experienced in 2020 and the aftermath of the 2020 election? Has that gotten through, or people, to use the phrase that we hear so often now, or is that being memory-holed?
A little of both, I would say, or maybe a lot of both. But look, I think as much as there were, obviously we had January 6th, we had uncertainty around the election, et cetera. I think there is a sense that we managed through the institutions held, the state level institutions held, and that can create complacency that, okay, there were risks, but it didn't happen. And so we don't really expect that now. And that kind of optimism is not a bad thing, that we as a country have the kind of wherewithal to manage those kinds of risks. However, I do know some companies who are doing very significant planning for what risks could occur. One of the things we have is a report card by state of the state of democracy in that state, because the reality is it is state by state. And one of the variables, it's based on objective data, but one of the variables, we have an overall score, A to D, right? In terms of how good are you at access voter turnout and how gerrymandered are your districts and what are the rules around campaign finance, et cetera. And for instance, on that, New York State has been a C because it has closed primaries that dampen participation. You didn't have early voting. It's gerrymandered, et cetera. Wisconsin has also been a C. So it's not just red state, blue state. But then we have a binary variable, which is red light, green light on election risk, right? Have there been real efforts? So I think companies have to have an opportunity to be much more prepared. And that includes evaluating your footprint state by state. I would put one of the states we put at the highest risk right now is Arizona, because 80% of election administrators have left their jobs.
80%.
80%. We have new people administering elections. There was very deliberate targeting. Part of the reason why 80% have left is there was very deliberate targeting of election administrators, many Republican, to say, we don't believe the results that you reported. And now you're going to be subject to harassment, to targeting of you on social media. You're going to get protests at your home. It's been very severe. Now we're seeing the business community concerned and engaging more now in that state. We see some very good, both Republican and Democratic election administrators who are at a leadership level, who are staying in their jobs, who are working to address that in the state. But it's a real risk. So if I had operations as a company in Arizona, I'm a leadership team member, I'm a board member, I want to know how we're ready to either proactively support time off to poll work by our employees, but also what is our plan for our operations if there is unrest or uncertainty in the state? So I think this is a state-by-state analysis to be done, but of course there's also macro risk concerns. We know that a very uncertain election can affect overall operations. And then there's post-election, right? So depending on the policy environment that you have, I think the thing you've seen reported the most on is trade policy, for instance. So there's been discussion by the former president and his presumed economic advisors around across the board 10% tariffs, right? 60% tariffs on China, all these things, the supply chain disruptions of those. Are you and your business prepared for that type of change? We really recommend pre-election risks, being prepared for kind of the polarization pre-election, the risks that could happen during, and then being prepared for what could happen next.
For what it's worth, BSR is framing it exactly the same way, and you can play out a range of scenarios in each of those three categories, and there are some connections certainly between the three, but I think it's a really smart way to think about it. So you've done a great job of laying out some of the risks that I think all of us as citizens face, that all of us who want to see rule of law and democratic processes be stable and secure and so on. Take it down. And you've alluded to this a little bit, supply chain, et cetera. But when you talk to, let's say, a skeptical business leader who says, yeah, I got a lot on my plate. There's all this AI stuff. And by the way, this is politics and I don't want to get into a partisan mess. What's the best case to make for someone who says, yeah, I see it, but I got my day job. I'm not going to worry about it too much. How do you make that case?
Look, I think the way arguably over the last 8 years, and not that there's not been a nexus of political risk and uncertainty for all of political time, but where we've seen there is this real nexus between uncertainty, chaotic policymaking, chaotic governance, and both like specific policy decisions that can happen, but also all the things that can happen around that. So if you consider all the time that leaders have spent in responding to, whether it's been after the death of George Floyd, as we look at even things like the Supreme Court abortion ruling, as we look at things like dropping out of and then rejoining the Paris Agreement, et cetera, like those have been very significant, kind of require very significant time and business response. And so if we're in, I think all evidence that we would see is that the potential for a lot of chaos and uncertainty around this election and after this election. And even right now, we're seeing that Washington can't make any decisions because we're going to wait to do anything about immigration until we have an election. And then presumably we will still have nothing on immigration. So there's just like all of these things really add up. And I think it's pretty hard to argue that somehow one can just operate above the fray on all this. Now, I understand the direct line of what do? How do you respond, et cetera, is not always wholly clear. But I think if you do, one of the things we recommend is that boards or leadership teams do a systematic risk review, right? Look across those risk factors I talked about, governing risk, political retribution, societal risk, and what are the nexus points with their company? And because also there's a lot of, I think one of the challenges we've had, and this is also relevant to ESG, et cetera, is this feeling that leaders are playing whack-a-mole all the time, right? You're constantly responding to something. And I would argue that part of the reason you're constantly responding is because the political system is also not delivering what people need. Right. And you're the only man or woman standing left as the CEO to go to. And so it is in the medium term and long term, it is deeply in the interest of CEOs and companies to have a functional political system that takes some of that heat off of the leaders. But in the shorter term, that manifests itself in being prepared, going systematically through these different risks and knowing what they mean for your business and finding the places you can be proactive, right? Okay. Giving time off for your, like I said, for your employees, for voting and for poll working, encouraging civic engagement. We've seen both in Wisconsin, the business leaders there, and as I mentioned, Arizona, proactively celebrating election administrators who are serving their job, our Wisconsin group wrote a letter to every election administrator thanking them on behalf of them as business leaders in their community and making really clear that this was really important and making that visible. So those seem like small things, but actually in a world, I think that there's big and small things to be done. And look, business also interacts with political leaders all the time. Many do. And said subtly, encouraging them to respect the system, said less subtly, if they're not respecting the system, telling them to cut it out or that you won't work with them. I think the one mistake that companies make in this space is to see themselves as just like a market taker, like that these things are happening and we just are receivers of the risk. And I do believe, look, America is like, business is the first sector. Business is above government in terms of its influence, resources, and just like credibility, frankly. So I don't think we should underestimate the impact of business asking the political system to be more sane. And that doesn't have to be on like a specific policy. It just has to be on like how we conduct our elections and our processes of governing, as opposed to what exactly the outcome is.
Let's drill down on that a little bit. And I want to ask about a couple of specific dimensions of that. And then a reminder, please, if you have a question or a comment, please use the Q&A tab. So I'd love to get your reaction on a few things. So one is political contributions. How should we think about that? Engagement in business associations, trade associations, which are most often focused on tax, trade, and regulation and less so on democracy protection, number two. Number three, what about public statements? We did see some in the wake of the 2020 election, and we saw some action post January 6th. Companies are reluctant to do that. But as you say, I share your view. Companies should not just think of themselves as passive recipients of the political system, but as having some agency in trying to shape things. So what would you advise business leaders to do in each of those three areas?
Yeah, so I'll start with political spending and influence. I think there are proactive things that companies can do. And then there's an element of do no harm, right? Which is, one does not want to intentionally or most likely inadvertently make it easier to undermine the system. And so I think the challenge we always face is, okay, what's the purpose of business interacting with government? Is it around a specific tax and regulatory issue related to my industry? Or what are the layers after that I care about? And there's always discussion on that. Do I care about climate? Do I care about LGBT issues? And what is the reason for making those issues something you might include in your engagement or lobbying or otherwise with political leader or your political contributions? And I think, look, we would argue that something like refusing to accept election results, rhetoric that's suggesting illegitimacy of the system, et cetera, is something that falls fairly close to a corporate interest, like a tax and regulatory interest. Of course, it's more generalized, but one of the things that we look at is like, how would you evaluate that? Okay, let's look at where we put resources, both at a state level, like in state governors associations and attorney general associations, into particular political candidates, et cetera. And ultimately, that's a discussion to be had in the company, on a PAC board, on a leadership team, et cetera. But I think really being thoughtful about, if you only look at like tax and regulatory influence of a political leader that you engage with, I would argue that you could miss some really significant, from a risk perspective even, right? You might be writing a check to someone whose create was like going to be embarrassment for your company is a big risk. If you add like 15 issues or 10 issues onto that, then you go to the other level where you can't even figure out why you're supporting them anymore, right? So I think being really thoughtful about what are a limited number of things we can also take into consideration at a minimum from a risk perspective and potentially also from like the proactive issue, what we want to think in a world. But what we find with a lot of companies, that analysis and discussion never happens.
Yeah. Let me follow up on that, because I think one of the issues that we see is there's a little bit of a tragedy of the commons dimension to this, that a business leader will say, oh, our democracy is crumbling. This is horrible for all of us, which is true. When I look at a change in tax law, when I look at a new regulation, I've got people quantifying that for my bottom line. My shareholders are asking about it. So yeah, it applies to everybody, but I can be certain about how it's going to affect me. So how do we break that down so that there is more of a sense of, I would say, a shared ownership of some of the broader democracy questions that we're talking about today?
Yeah, look, I think a basic thing is when you look at specific candidates or industry associations or political entities that one supports, that the analysis, in my experience, of that support is much less thin, is much thinner than the analysis of, like you said, the impact of a tax or regulatory issue, or generally when you make an investment decision, right? In part because the numbers aren't huge, frankly. Often you're writing some checks that are relatively not enormous, but actually can really matter for who you're writing it to. So I think having a couple of additional data points, right, on what has this institution done that's been supporting trust in the system or that has undermined it? What exactly did that look like? Were there statements? Was there a vote on a particular bill, et cetera? And I think it requires us getting to some of that detail.
Yeah.
And then I think you can relate that back to your risk review that says, whoa, am I going to have to shut down my operations in Arizona for a week or a month? Or are my employees going to be like unable to work because they're so concerned about what's going on? Am I going to have this inability to actually even cost effectively source my inputs to my products? So I do think some quantification on that side, if you tie that like political funding decision to the risks to your overall system, then that all of a sudden becomes like real money, real impact, et cetera.
The way you described it is really interesting, because I was starting to think that what you're describing is in effect a different kind of infrastructure. Just like companies rely on physical infrastructure that's a shared cost across societies, we need the political infrastructure so that there's the stable scaffolding of society, if you will, that enables us to get up and do what we need to do every day without concerns that I'm not sure how far I can take this analogy. What is the political bridge that could fall down and prevent things from happening? But I think it's conceptually somewhat the same. We did have one question, and I want to toss it your way because it's a good question, and I hope it will maybe encourage some other questions. So basically, the essence of the question is this, that we say we would like corporate engagement to protect democracy. I would imagine most people on this Zoom would agree with that. However, corporate engagement and policy, according to this questioner, can also be self-serving and harmful. And I think we've seen that, regulatory capture and so on. So do we really want companies out of politics or engaged positively? What are the trade-offs? How do we define, and let alone promote, but define what we consider, quote unquote, responsible corporate political involvement? Because there may not be a consensus on that.
Yeah. No, look, it's a great question. And very inherent to my own organization, right? Which is, do we need a bunch of business people like here telling us what to do about democracy? Is that productive? Is that more harm than good? And you know, what I would argue is in nearly every society, even ones that would be considered to have a stronger social safety net, let's take a country like Sweden, for instance, the business sector, I mean, even if you change the U.S. campaign finance laws, which I argue we should, because I do think that they do things that are unhelpful to distort the system. Business is the biggest, most people work in a business. It's the biggest part of the economy. There would always be interaction between business leaders and the government on any number of things, because our trade relationships are defined by international trade agreements that I always think about Scandinavia, which I know fairly well. I have a Norwegian husband. If you think about Sweden, if there's a big policy decision happening and we think about Scandinavia's not having a lot of business influence, do you think the government doesn't talk to the big business leaders and try to build some consensus around that? Because they're an important, influential part of society. So I think if we ignore that there could be this completely pure system, which has never existed, I think then we get to not great outcomes. All of that said, I would say that the culture of business engagement and politics that we have right now is often not helpful because it's transactional. It's how do I get this regulation that I need? I write a check. And that helps me make sure I can address that kind of narrow interest, as opposed to a somewhat broader conception of this pillar of society's interaction with government. And I would blame a variety of factors and both sides to some extent in this regard, that I get frustrated because I will see government or this administration not as strategically engaging with business and solve problems. And then government and business do the same thing where they just are very transactional. I say all of that not to suggest we shouldn't change any of the rules of the game that would help move things in the right direction. But I think we don't have time to fix all of those things before we all come together to make sure our system goes on the right track. Yes. So you know what I mean? So I don't think we can be too purist in the short term, even while working towards the longer term.
Speaking about not having time to wait for comprehensive solutions, I would be remiss if I didn't raise the question of misinformation, disinformation, and deepfakes and so on. So how are you thinking about that? What are you seeing in terms of risks and concerns? We could probably spend the rest of this time swapping stories about some amazing ways deepfakes are being used, amazing and alarming ways deepfakes are being used. And what are you seeing? Because there are some steps to combat this from business, particularly in the tech sector, which is on the front lines of this question. But how are you thinking about that here in 2024 as the technology seems to outrace our ability to manage it?
Yeah, it happens. We hosted a panel yesterday at Harvard Business School on AI and the election with Google and an academic. And we were discussing what this looks like with students and alumni. I don't think there are any easy answers. I do think there are some efforts by industry to reduce the impact, make it more clear where images come from, stop some of the most egregious things. But I don't think anyone would argue, including them, that they're going to be able to wholly stem the tide of disinformation, AI-generated images, everything that we're going to see in this election. And I hate to say it, I do think it's going to influence. There's going to be influence that could influence outcomes. But it's not, I guess what I would say is that as much as there will be influence, I don't think it's like a influence that is 20% or 10% swings in perceptions. It's more on the margins. And so that doesn't mean it couldn't be definitive, but like what you said earlier, I really believe like we have to have a feeling of agency. So if we thought that like social media, AI, et cetera, you could turn a button and deliver an outcome for an election, that's scary. I think it's more nuanced than that, but it does mean we have to work extra hard to try to combat what we know is going to happen in this space. And that means like informing. I'm still surprised so much of what one sees in social media is manipulated and otherwise, and we need people to understand that what they're seeing is being fed to them. They have to use critical thinking, go to original sources, et cetera. And that's something we've seen companies in Germany and elsewhere really informing their employees about disinformation risks, et cetera. And that doesn't have to even be the context of the election, right? That can just be in how to spot disinformation, how to think about it, how to counter it. The case study that's striking to me and a reminder that this is not purely also one party versus the other thing or otherwise is that what we've seen in, for instance, the Republican primary is a quite deliberate effort, first George Ron DeSantis and then Nikki Haley, of a very kind of widespread campaign of disinformation about them. So DeSantis, the question said he wore high heels and questioned his sexuality and all this, and then Haley has questioned where she was born and her loyalties and all of these things. And that wasn't just in a few places, that was replicated across the internet in very significant ways with significant infrastructure. So I think tech companies have to do as much as they can. We have to make people as inoculated to the disinformation as we can be. And then really in the medium term, definitely need some policy solutions, but now it's going to be more just pushing against, like pushing in various different ways to remind people of what matters.
We've got about 10 minutes left, so one last call for any questions. And I think the point about promoting media literacy strikes me as something that businesses can and should do. They can partner to do that. It's something that does not, by definition, is not a partisan activity. It's something that quite frankly, all 335 million Americans need more of. And in a media environment where the statistics are striking about how last thing I saw was that for Americans under the age of 30, 50% of them get the majority of their quote unquote news, however you define that these days, from TikTok. This is not Walter Cronkite's America, to say the least. It's not even Ted Turner's CNN America. It's an incredibly fragmented environment where a number of perceived truths can thrive and prosper. So let me, in the remaining minutes, I actually want to turn this inside out in terms of US vis-a-vis the rest of the world. I've long had the view that one of the greatest assets that American businesses have is the soft power, that cultural otherwise, that comes along with being an American business. And I've seen this in action. I've seen American businesses, including in places like China, earn the trust and respect of employees because there's a sense that America is committed to fair play. And let's just state for the record, we know this is far from a perfect country, but respect for diversity, respect for a rules-based culture, and so on. How is this coming up in your dialogue? It worries me that American companies are allowing this amazing asset that's been built up over decades to be seriously eroded and not undermined. Do you see that as an issue? Is that something that resonates with businesses?
Yeah, I think I always hear a lot of concerns from Europeans and other international business leaders about the state of US politics, what it means for the US. I remember living in Europe around the early 2000s, mid-2000s, and there was always a little bit of an attitude that love to hate the US. And now, Now the attitude is, we're worried about you. We want you to be okay. We love to hate you, but we don't want you to totally fail.
We don't hate you that much, actually.
Yeah, exactly. So I do think there is a lot of concern, and there's brand America has been eroded. I think that's a concern. And frankly, that's why part of why you see things like Jamie Dimon at Davos saying it's going to be okay no matter what happens, right? That's part of the reaction to wanting to keep brand America strong, regardless of political outcomes, regardless of uncertainty. And so I think in some ways it goes back to the only way that you keep that brand is by working on it and investing in it. And that brand America is not the product of just any one company's actions. And it's not the product of all of the businesses put together. It's the product of both all of our institutions, invisible institutions, et cetera. And I fear that there were sometimes a naive orientation to some of this too, which is Europeans always love to hate the US, like business always loves to hate government, right? Oh, it's like ineffective and it's bad. And we've seen recently in a whole other realm, but like higher education, right? Everyone likes to hate Harvard and everyone, there's plenty of opportunities for the takedown of institutions that kind of have felt too powerful or felt, but I think if we remember that the takedown of any of those institutions is the takedown of the whole, right? All of those, business, government, higher education, when they are under attack, it damages brand America. Now, that doesn't mean we should never criticize each other, that there's not anything warranted about all of it. But I think we have to remember that in the end, at some point, the takedown has to go back to what's the best out. Business will always exist. Government will always exist. Higher education will always exist. We can complain and we can, you know, be concerned, but how do we make them actually as good as they possibly can be in representing what we all want to see in the world? And we're definitely at a place where that kind of expansive thinking feels pretty far away from the current context, but at some point, that's how you break out of this, is what is it that we want our institutions to be so we can be our best selves and be our best nation and otherwise.
Really well said, really important. So one last question for you. So let's pretend it's 2028. So the next presidential election cycle, what is one thing that you really hope that will have transpired between now and then? And what is your biggest fear about what may have transpired between now and then? And maybe start with the fear so we can end on a high note.
Sure. I think that there's like a lot of fears. I'm trying to come to one. So, but look, I think the fear is that faith in the system is so low that you both have extremely low participation and really not credible candidates. You just have, and look, we have some of that right now, frankly, right? But that you really get to a place where it's like, this is not offering me things that are helpful or relevant. And America's kind of disconnected increasingly from the world and each other, and a sense of hopelessness from the electorate and from where we go. So I think that would be like the worst case scenario. Yeah. We can avoid
real collapse in trust.
Yeah, huge collapse in trust and faith in the system. On the hopeful side, I see a lot of, if I compare now to 2016 in terms of level of engagement, new talent that's entered politics, like reforms that are happening at a state level, the types of people I see paying attention and willing to engage, et cetera, as much as people are tired and frustrated, et cetera, I see a lot of compelling governors in this country from both parties. The governors give me a lot of hope. I see, you know, proactive policymaking also happening at a state level. And I see business people who, as much tired as they are, the reason why you've seen things like ESG and others flourish is a recognition that business is not this complete narrow enterprise that operates disconnected from society. So I think we have all those elements. I think we could, in the spirit of making predictions, which I often stay away from, but
with good reason, but go for it.
Why not? Right. Yeah. I think we could have women candidates in both parties. And that's a really interesting scenario, because then it's not about gender, right? Like, let the best.
Yeah.
So I think that could be really interesting and exciting, and just change the dynamic of the conversation from one of just, we're just like sick and tired, which is the risk right now. But my last thing I would say is, don't be sick and tired. This is important. There is influence we can have on making this, reducing risk and making this election smoother.
Making democracy great again. Oh, did I say that? Daniela, thank you for the great work you do. Thanks for an engaging conversation. I'd really encourage everybody, go to Leadership Now Project's site. A lot of great resources there. We're really excited to be partnering with you and your team as we work on this at BSR. So thank you. And I would say, lastly, just for people who have been loyal participants, we're going to skip March. We're going to be back at you in April with our next installment. So stay tuned. We'll have some information on that for you soon. Thanks to everyone who joined. Daniela, thanks to you. And Suze has had to leave. Thanks to Suze and the MOFO team.
Please make sure to subscribe to the MOFO Perspectives podcast so you don't miss an episode. If you have any questions about what you heard today or would like more information on this topic, please visit mofo.com/podcasts. Again, that's mofo.com/podcasts.